questions, and TSD's chemists struggled to find the correct weapon, a lethal but slow-acting pill that would give the agent time to slip away before taking effect. The first batches of poison capsules failed to dissolve adequately in water, but the second batch worked in trials on monkeys and was issued to a Cuban official for the attempt. The official later returned the pills after getting cold feet. From 1960 through the end of 1965, various schemes, some whimsical and some serious, were discussed and evaluated to eliminate Castro. Of the conceived and planned attacks on Castro that encompassed public embarrassment as well as assassination, none came close to succeeding. The variety of plans that were considered to undermine Castro's charismatic appeal by sabotaging his speeches was reminiscent of William Donovan's admonition to Stanley Lovell to raise merry hell. These included hallucinogenic spray. One TSD scientist and bioorganic chemist proposed spraying Castro's broadcasting studio in Havana with a chemical to induce LSD-like hallucinations. TSD eventually found out, however, that the chemical was unreliable. Hallucinogenic cigars. Since the method of introducing the spray into the room was not possible, Scheider suggested impregnating Castro's cigars with a special chemical to produce temporary disorientation during one of his long, rambling speeches, which were broadcast live to the Cuban people. Contaminated shoes. A plan was evaluated to attack Castro's famous beard when he was traveling abroad by contaminating his shoes when they were placed outside his hotel room door at night to be shined. The idea was to dust the inside of the shoes with thallium salts, a strong depilatory which, when absorbed into the body, would cause Castro's beard to fall out. TSD procured the chemical and tested it successfully on animals before the DDP scrapped the plan when Castro canceled his trip. Depilatory cigars. Similar in concept to the failed shoe attack, under this scheme, Castro's cigars were to be treated with a powerful depilatory that would cause his beard to fall out, leaving him hairless as a means of damaging his macho image. The special box of cigars was to be provided to Castro during his appearance on a television talk show hosted by David Susskind. After CIA officer David Atlee Phillips questioned how the operation could ensure that only Castro and not others, including Susskind, would smoke the cigars, the idea was abandoned. Phillips made the point that assassination schemes required both effective technical substances and precise operational planning. Poisoned cigars. The CIA recruited a double agent to offer Castro a Cohiba cigar, his favorite brand, treated with botulin, a toxin so deadly that the target would die shortly after putting the cigar into his mouth. CIA records indicate that the cigars were passed to the double agent in February of 1961, but he apparently decided against carrying out the plan. Exploding cigars. During a Castro visit to the United Nations, the CIA considered a plan to plant a box of exploding cigars at a place where he would smoke one and blow his head off. The plan was not carried out. Exploding seashells. In early 1963, TSD was asked to construct a seashell with explosives to be planted in the ocean at a spot in which Castro commonly went skin diving. After a technical and operational review, CIA discarded the idea as impractical. Contaminated diving suit. A proposal was made for a U.S. lawyer involved with official negotiations over the release of prisoners captured at the Bay of Pigs to present Castro with a contaminated diving suit. TSD bought a diving suit, dusted it inside with a fungus, which would produce Madura foot, a chronic skin disease, and contaminated the breathing apparatus with a tubercle bacillus. The plan was abandoned when the lawyer decided to present Castro with a different diving suit. Poisoned pen. On November 22, 1963, the day that President Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, a CIA officer offered a poison pen to a Cuban agent, Amlash, in Paris, for use against Castro. TSD had modified the ballpoint pen with a hypodermic needle designed to be so fine that the target, Castro, would not sense its insertion, and the agent would have time to escape before effects were noticed. Amlash was instructed to use Black Leaf 40, a commercial poison, with the device, but in the aftermath of Kennedy's assassination, he decided against taking the pen back to Cuba. Suppressed pistol and rifle. The CIA subsequently provided Amlash with a suppressed pistol and suppressed FAL rifle and scope, as well as highly concentrated explosives. Amlash took no action, and in June of 1965, the CIA terminated contact with him. The DDP's planning of assassination attacks on other foreign leaders, such as Patrice Lumumba of the Congo, also drew on TSD's research, production, and delivery capabilities. The initial plan to eliminate Lumumba involved putting poison into his food or toothpaste. A syringe, surgical mask, rubber gloves, and a vial of toxin were sent to the Congo for the operation. However, the plot failed when moral objections to assassination were raised by senior officers of the agency's DDP, as well as the difficulty in gaining access to Lumumba's entourage. Ultimately, the plot became unnecessary when opposition Congo forces killed Lumumba in January 1961. With the exception of the Amlash operation, assassination of foreign leaders as a policy option for the United States ended on November 22, 1963, when President Kennedy was shot in Dallas, Texas. It would be more than a decade before the Rockefeller Commission, 1975, and the Church Committee, 1975 to 1976, provided the American public insight into the CIA's secret role in the assassination schemes that clustered in the 1959 to 1963 years. Obscured by the sensationalism and intrigue of the plots and technologies were the conclusions of both investigations. With respect to assassination planning, the Rockefeller and Church reports determined that CIA officers acted on accurately understood policy direction from the White House under both the Eisenhower and Kennedy administrations. In response to the two reports, President Ford issued Executive Order 11905 that contained the provision, "No employee of the United States government shall engage in or conspire to engage in political assassination." Subsequently, a revised 1981 Executive Order 12333 governing intelligence activities reaffirmed the prohibition. No person employed by or acting on behalf of the United States government shall engage in or conspire to engage in assassination. The EO added that no agency of the intelligence community shall participate in or request any person to undertake activities forbidden by this order, language that explicitly prohibited indirect participation in assassination. Serious public discussion of assassination as a U.S. policy option ended with these executive orders, but it would be rekindled after the September 11, 2001 Al-Qaeda terrorist attacks. A December 2001 Newsweek poll found that 65% of those surveyed supported assassination of Al-Qaeda leaders. The dramatic change in public opinion likely reflects the contrast between the potential danger perceived from Castro and the reality that Al-Qaeda, a non-state organization, carried out attacks on American cities, airlines, and civilians. Even in that environment, however, it remains unlikely the U.S. public would support authorized covert assassination operations against the head of a recognized foreign government. Chapter 17, War by Any Other Name. We had a war going, but nobody knew. OTS officer in Vietnam, 1962. TSD officer Pat Jameson was sitting on a hard bench in Saigon's Tan Son Nhuc Airport in 1962, studying the aircraft traffic as he waited for another agency officer's flight to arrive. A Pan American plane landed for refueling, and Jameson watched as a group of American tourists disembarked. Walking across the tarmac through the glare of the Southeast Asian sun, they made their way to the promising shade of the drab building, eager to see what exotic souvenirs the ramshackle terminal might hold. Perhaps drawn by an American, or at least Western, face, one of the tourists approached Jameson. "I hear there's a war going on down here. Is that right?" the tourist asked Jameson casually, as if he were inquiring about the weather in some distant city. Jameson nodded toward a corner of the tarmac. Look out there. You see that? There's a bunch of people being taken from that plane to ambulances, he said. And there's some new guys with fatigue creases in their pants getting on that same plane to go upcountry to replace those dead and injured ones. That's the story that we're living with here.
God, I never knew that,
the tourist exclaimed as he stared at the scene. More than 40 years later, Jameson reflected on a scene he remembered vividly. We had a war going, but nobody knew. That a tourist on a brief layover was unaware of the situation in Vietnam was not surprising. For most of the American public in 1962, Vietnam was an obscure and distant country of little consequence. Seemingly just another former European colony in turmoil, news of Vietnam's problems was usually confined to the back pages of the morning paper. The French Indochina War of the early 1950s had been largely forgotten or ignored outside of foreign affairs wonks at the CIA, State Department, and Pentagon. For those concerned about Vietnam's history and future, 1954 was the year keenly remembered. That spring, the French suffered a decisive defeat at Dien Bien Phu when 70,000 Vietnamese soldiers overwhelmed their 13,000-man outpost. The Vietnamese had dragged howitzers and other heavy artillery along the ridgeline of the isolated valley north of Hanoi, and then fired directly down into the French garrison. Led by General Giap, tens of thousands of troops endured not only the hard physical labor of moving artillery over jungle trails, but also repeated strafing by French aircraft. DCI Alan Dulles directed the CIA's front airline in Southeast Asia, Civil Air Transport, CAT, to fly resupply missions during the siege using unarmed C-119 flying boxcars cargo aircraft, while the U.S. military sent 50 B-26s for air support operations to aid the beleaguered garrison. Despite this U.S. assistance, which did little to turn the tide, President Eisenhower thought the French government's decision to make a stand at Dien Bien Phu ill-advised, and its efforts to keep Vietnam under colonial rule an invitation for the communists to gain an advantage. Eisenhower's assessment had been correct. The commander of the French garrison, sensing defeat was at hand, committed suicide with a hand grenade. The siege, which lasted from March until early May, effectively ended French colonial rule in Indochina, but brought no lasting peace. An international conference, convened in Geneva during July of 1954, offered a plan to create a unified Vietnamese government following democratic elections in 1956. However, the Geneva Agreement was not endorsed by the United States and resulted in a negotiated standoff that included a temporary division between North and South along a demilitarized zone at the 17th parallel. Two countries emerged from the agreement, the communist-ruled Democratic Republic of Vietnam in the north and the Republic of Vietnam in the south. Almost immediately, Ho Chi Minh's regime embarked on a protracted campaign of guerrilla warfare to unify Vietnam under communist rule. The United States, practicing a policy of Cold War containment, was determined not to let that happen. When Jameson encountered the American tourist in Saigon, U.S. paramilitary support to the South Vietnamese consisted of advisors from both CIA and U.S. Army Special Forces. The Eisenhower administration committed American assistance to South Vietnam, but limited efforts to advising and assisting the South Vietnamese government in unconventional warfare, paramilitary operations, and political psychological warfare. This role expanded during the Kennedy administration to include CIA paramilitary support with substantial assistance from special forces to interdict material flowing from the north to the Viet Cong in the south. With limited news coverage and the relatively small commitment of U.S. forces, few Americans recognized Vietnam as a war zone. The fighting did not resemble the battlefields of Europe during World War II or those of the more recent Korean conflict. The Viet Cong guerrillas, with no means to mount large-scale military attacks, concentrated on building espionage networks within the South Vietnamese government and carrying out terrorist-like attacks on selected targets. Jameson had been sent to Vietnam by TSD to support the agency's covert action program. His role as an authentication officer carried on a tradition that reached back two decades to similar work done by OSS. Just as the OSS had reproduced German and French documents for agents sent into occupied Europe, TSD was now outfitting South Vietnamese agents with documents and clothing for infiltration missions into the North to conduct intelligence gathering, sabotage, and harassment operations. However, the situation Jameson found in Vietnam suggested that TSD could do more than just provide documentation. Another small TSD unit had experience in training and equipping paramilitary forces through its involvement with the ill-fated 1961 Bay of Pigs invasion. Now, a year later, TSD's paramilitary and authentication units were combined to form a covert action element. As the only member of the new group in Vietnam, Jameson assumed the paramilitary responsibility as well. The primary problem that confronted the CIA and the South Vietnamese government in 1962 was halting the flow of munitions and personnel entering South Vietnam from the north. The principal infiltration routes were Highway 1, an intermittently paved road running along Vietnam's eastern coast, and the better-known Ho Chi Minh Trail, an intricate 20,000-kilometer network of roads and jungle trails. The Ho Chi Minh Trail ran along Vietnam's western border, cutting southward through Laos and Cambodia. For Jameson and other agency personnel, shutting down the flow of weapons and personnel meant taking the fight to the enemy by destroying the infrastructure along both supply routes. It was to become a counterinsurgency war, fought by small, fast-moving teams. Employing unconventional warfare tactics and clandestine weaponry similar to those used by the OSS, U.S. military advisors worked with special units of the South Vietnamese Army and indigenous groups, such as the Montagnards and ethnic Chinese Nungs. However, waging this type of war required training and detailed planning. When doing sabotage, folks tended to focus on the big bang, the explosive charge in your hand, Jameson said. Part of my job was to make sure all the other pieces were in place. Leave out one of those, and you'll leave a bridge standing or lose your team. Planning for sabotage, Jameson recalled, required exhaustive sessions, sometimes taking 2 or 3 days for a single mission. Every detail, from the daily rations to intelligence about the target's precise orientation, materials, and appearance, had to be addressed. Destroying just one bridge required logistics, explosives, first aid, communications equipment, and a means to get the team in and out safely. The team had to be trained to handle explosives, set charges, and improvise in the field when necessary. All the intelligence about possible entry and exit routes had to be assembled and considered, since there would only be one chance to bring down the bridge. We had to diagnose the construction of that bridge, often with little data, and design explosive charges to do the job, said Jameson, but not use P equals plenty. If you want something destroyed, use the right amount of explosives at the weakest point. We taught the Vietnamese how to attach the explosives quickly and set the time delays that allowed the team to get out before the explosion. Jameson devised an easy-to-remember acronym, CARVER, to guide preparation of the target package. Criticality assessed the importance or critical role of the target for the enemy. Accessibility asked if the team had a reasonable chance of getting to the target. Recognizability meant the team would know the target when they saw it. Vulnerability focused on a realistic appraisal of the degree of damage or destruction that could be done to the target. Effect addressed the impact destruction of the target would have on the enemy. Recoverability estimated the time and effort required for restoration or reconstruction of the target. Taken together, the elements of CARVER provided both the planners in the field and those authorizing an operation at headquarters with a risk and benefit analysis to make sound operational decisions. It was foolish, Jameson reasoned, to engage in high-risk operations unless the probability of success was also high. Target analysis told us how to get the most bang for the buck with limited assets, said one of Jameson's fellow officers. It worked like a flow sheet that described how something worked and then led your thinking to identify the weakest point to be attacked. TSD became engaged in Vietnam as early as 1961, when a marine engineer was dispatched to Hong Kong to overhaul agency-purchased Chinese junks. Although still conventional in appearance, the junks were far from ordinary by the time the engineer was done with them. The tech replaced the standard propulsion systems with Gray Marine 671 diesel engines that boosted speed from a modest 3 knots to impressive 15 knots. He also added a pair of 55-gallon fuel drums lashed to the masts, concealing 50-caliber machine guns, and a battery of camouflaged 3.5-inch rockets on top of the wheelhouse, rigged to a firing switch within the captain's easy reach. Finally, the engineer built a covered hiding place beneath the deck for a pair of crewmen armed with 9mm Swedish K submachine guns. The junks were deployed for covert patrol and infiltration operations along the Vietnamese coast north of the DMZ. If approached by a hostile patrol boat, the junks' reaction was both surprising and devastating. A seaworthy rubber raft known as the Zodiac, which grew out of a TSS project codenamed RB-12 during the Korean conflict, became the mainstay of amphibious infiltration operations into North Vietnam. These rafts carried landing teams launched by the modified junk motherships to the insertion points along the coast. To track the rafts after launching, the techs adapted cherry-top flashers, similar to those used on early police cars, lining them with Kodak gelatin filters, numbers 87, 87C, 88A, or 89B, through which light only in the infrared spectrum passed. When lit from within, the covert flashers were invisible to the naked eye, but could be seen by using a T7 metascope, a handheld, battery-operated infrared optical device. Training of poorly motivated Vietnamese guerrilla fighters proved problematic. The Vietnamese government provided the requisite numbers of bodies for sabotage and harassment operations, but they were unqualified and difficult to train, Jameson explained. Many of the young men they supplied were just people the government wanted to get off the streets, city kids, and not country boys who understood how to hunt and shoot. We kept saying, without much response, "Give us some country boys, and don't give us these city thugs." This became apparent during one covert mission that called for a CIA-trained 4-man Vietnamese team to infiltrate the north and destroy a bridge on Highway 1, cutting off, at least temporarily, a major Viet Cong supply route. As planned, the team would launch from the junk in a Zodiac raft, land on the beach, trek 5 miles inland to the bridge, plant the time-delayed charge, then hike back to the Zodiac hidden on the beach, and return to the junk. On the night of the operation, the team launched on schedule and began reporting their location by radio as the Zodiac approached the landing site. At the command post on the junk, Jameson noted the progress as the team reported reaching point 1, point 2, and point 3. The mission looked good. A few minutes later came the next report, point 3, then point 2. Clearly, the team was returning. When the Zodiac pulled alongside the junk, one of the Vietnamese team members pointed to water in the bottom of the raft from what seemed to be a leak. Jameson, skeptical, inspected the raft and found multiple holes, all made by knife blades. When questioned, team members admitted that after launch, they had become frightened and sabotaged the mission. "Those guys went to jail," Jameson recounted, "but we learned an important lesson. Find a higher caliber of agent. We recruited 4 Nungs and trained them for the operation." Several weeks later, the Nung team launched from the same junk and encountered no trouble reaching the beach, landing, or finding the right trail to the bridge. Following the operational plan, they attached the explosive charges to the bridge support structure. Once secured, they activated the time-delay devices and departed the area using a different trail than the one used to approach the target. Overhead photos the next day confirmed that the bridge dropped exactly as planned. Other high-value targets called for a more creative approach. A North Vietnamese petroleum depot that provided fuel for equipment moving into South Vietnam was one such target. Unlike the bridge, the heavily guarded facility was surrounded by chain-link fences and unapproachable by saboteurs using conventional explosive charges. since airstrikes were not authorized at that stage of the war, the most effective option was to attack from a standoff position. A rocket attack could potentially take out the fuel tanks, but only if a small team could carry enough firepower close to the target. Then they would have to set up, aim precisely, and fire all the rockets for a reasonable chance of hitting the fuel tanks and elude whatever response the attack elicited. The solution devised by TSD would later be called the Triple Tube Rocket Launcher. The genesis of the Triple Tube Launcher, what we call the TTL, started with a single anti-tank rocket fired from an improvised launcher that wasn't much more than a piece of angle iron, said one tech who followed the development of the device. The original concept was to fire a 3.5-inch anti-tank rocket by stuffing a wad of match heads and time fuse in the back end. Crude but simple, it was used in urban guerrilla warfare scenarios like the Hungarian uprising, with a civilian population combating tanks. We thought that if one rocket was good, then three ought to do a better job with greater chance of hitting a target. So we set the rockets with a 3-degree spread between tubes and added electrical firing for more precise command and control. The three-tube launcher was mounted on a modified backpack frame that allowed team members to accurately sight and adjust inclination. We tried to do all this so the saboteurs didn't have to do any thinking, Jameson explained. They'd just go in there and go right to the place where they've been shown, aim it like this, raise it, hit two buttons, and go. For the rockets to penetrate the tank's steel and ignite the fuel inside, the techs added incendiary adapters, aluminum packages filled with magnesium that would burn fiercely when exposed to oxygen after the initial explosion. Time delays were attached to the launcher package, allowing the team to initiate the firing sequence and head out of the area before launch. We didn't want to have our guys firing the rockets, then running like hell for 9 miles to the boats, said Jameson. So we adapted time delay mechanisms that gave the team several hours to get back to the rubber boats and head downriver before the rockets went off. To prevent spent rocket launchers from later being used against American troops, the techs added a self-destruct mechanism with 0.5 pound of explosives to destroy the unit after firing. But that left another concern. If an enemy patrol discovered the launchers before they fired, the NVA would acquire an effective weapon. TSD engineers responded by incorporating an anti-disturbance device. If tampering was detected after the safety was removed, the rockets launched automatically, and 1.35 seconds later, the explosives detonated. Another TSD innovation, the firefight simulator, resembled a collection of fireworks and other explosives set on a timer. The device mimicked the sound of automatic weapons fire, mortars, and grenades. U.S. military units infiltrated the simulators into enemy base camps to create diversion and confusion. In one instance, when the device went off in the middle of the night, the panicked and disoriented North Vietnamese began shooting each other. In 1962, the Kennedy administration initiated the transfer of covert Southeast Asian paramilitary programs from CIA to military control. The official date for the transfer was to be November 1, 1963. However, the timing was disrupted, first because of the overthrow and murder of South Vietnamese President Diem on November 2nd, then, 3 weeks later, by the assassination of President Kennedy on November 22nd. In December, a plan was approved by Defense Secretary Robert McNamara to increase covert attacks into North Vietnam, and in January 1964, the U.S. Military Assistance Command, Vietnam, MACV, organized a clandestine unit composed of Air Force Air Commandos, Army Special Forces, and Navy SEALs under the Special Operations Group, SOG. As the war effort expanded and troop numbers increased, the agency continued to maintain an active presence in Vietnam, with TSD playing a key role. Much of the early gear supplied by TSD was reminiscent of equipment issued by OSS during World War II, such as escape and evasion devices with concealed compasses and saws, as well as radios and clothing. We had a little packet about the size of a pack of cigarettes that illuminated an internal map, said Bill Parr, a TSD engineer at the time. By pushing down on the top of the package, the map inside would be dimly lit by a backlight. We gave the maps to teams working in North Vietnam, so if a team had to move at night, they could orient themselves.